playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. At least 10,000 people took to the streets of Dublin on Wednesday lunchtime to take part in the Raise the Roof rally. Students from all over the country joined trade unionists, mothers with kids in buggies, teachers, campaigners, demanding government action on the growing homeless crisis, as well as issues within the private rental market. Brian Lally was there for the late debate.
Some of the biggest issues that we have to deal with in Carnoukenny are housing issues. This is not some kind of, you know, joke where it's like, oh, it doesn't affect me. This will affect you. Our priorities are completely messed up in Ireland in relation to privatisation. We have so much publicly owned land, houses lying dormant and empty, and the one thing we're hearing the whole time from councils is, oh, it doesn't go in with fire regulations, it's not safety.
Rosemary from Dublin, and my sign says I wish it was as high as Dublin rent prices. One of my best friends, she's paying €900 for a room in Clonskey, and she shares that room with another person.
Jonathan Staines, and I'm here to take back the city and put a cap on rents so people can actually afford to live in their city.
I'm from Portlaoise, so, you know, commuting isn't an option for me, and I have to work 20 hours a week, as well as my parents working two jobs, and my grant is after being cut, and I can't afford housing.
I'm someone myself who has faced homelessness, and it makes life impossible. There's days where, like, you're afraid to go into lectures in case your landlord comes back and changes your locks, do you know what I mean?
Does this have to be a housing budget next week?
Definitely. We need to keep pushing this, as it has to be a red line issue for all of our politicians.
We're angry about paying huge extortionate rents for substandard accommodation. The government actually has to organise a proper conversation about what purpose-built student accommodation should be.
As protesters demonstrated outside, inside Dáil Éireann the debate was hot and heavy, with opposition parties backing a motion to declare the housing crisis a national emergency. Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald squared up to Taoiseach Leo Varadkar.
People know full well who the authors of this catastrophe is, and they know full well that it's not Sinn Féin. Far from acting as though we are in an emergency, you have been timid, you have been a lackey to private landlords, you have sat on the sidelines in the vain hope that the market will sort it all out, even though all of the evidence tells you that the market is not sorting this out. It's ensuring that you stop the despicable practice of landlords turfing families out to get vacant possession on properties that the state assisted these people to buy. Those are the things you need to do. And then let's go out to the gate and we'll test who has the credibility problem. Taoiseach.
Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin also took aim, claiming that the government hadn't delivered on its housing promises.
The repair and lease scheme, promised in early 2017, promised 800 houses, has delivered absolutely none. The affordable rental scheme, promised since 2015, has delivered nothing. Rapid build scheme announced in 2015 with a target of 1,500 houses has delivered 208.
On Morning Ireland yesterday, we heard the lived reality of homelessness. A year on, RTE's education correspondent Emma O'Kelly revisited Teresa and her family, who've been living in a hotel room for the past 2 years. Teresa lost her home when she was unable to keep up with mortgage payments following a marriage breakdown. Her daughter Amanda spoke with Emma. She's 18 years old, a secondary school student, repeating fifth year. But she worries that her homelessness will prevent her from making it into college.
Time is already flying by. It's already October and Christmas will come and then summer, and then next thing I know I blink and it's my leaving cert. And if I have to do my leaving cert in here, there's no chance of me going to college. There's no chance of me going forward in my education, because it'll just be useless.
You don't think you'd manage it in this hotel?
I wouldn't. I really wouldn't.
You mean in terms of studying and...
In terms of studying and even my own mental health, it's deteriorating for everyone. It's really diminishing and degrading. I haven't to wake up and look at the dirt around you. Over, like I said, the mould in between walls and behind curtains and everything else. It's horrible.
When you say your mental health is deteriorating, do you mind me asking what do you mean?
It's a struggle every day getting up and even just taking the blankets off yourself in the morning, it's horrible. People need to know that it is deadly to live like this. You do just want to, you feel like you have no left life left, living in here with no help, no sense of security. You just think, what's the point? You really do. It's not your fault. It's the likes of people who are supposed to do their jobs and they won't do it. They really won't.
Who are you referring to?
Leo Varadkar and Owen Murphy and everyone else that's sitting in that Doyle. It's their job to care, and if they shouldn't have the job. Give the job to someone that actually cares.
That's Amanda, who has been living in a hotel with her mom and family for 2 years now. She's now 18. She feels homelessness has stolen her teenage years. Very, very distressing, Emma.
Yes, indeed. Just finally, Audrey, hotel rooms were never designed for families to live in full time. That's why there's mould growing on the walls. As I left their hotel room yesterday afternoon, I saw small children, some in school uniforms, one in nappies, squatting on the floor of the hotel corridor outside, eating their dinner from takeaway cartons, fast food cartons that they had laid out on the floor. They were perched around these cartons. Teresa tells me that this is an everyday sight after school, in the afternoons, on the hotel corridor. But Audrey, it was a very sad sight.
Emma O'Kelly with Audrey Carville, as heard on yesterday's Morning Ireland. Well, not for the first time, Roddy Doyle has lifted the lid on a controversial topic. He's written a film called Rosie, which is about homelessness. It's his first screenplay in 18 years and was inspired by yet another powerful report he heard on Morning Ireland. Roddy was Marion Finucane's guest last Saturday.
2 years ago, I'd say almost literally 2 years ago, I was only half listening at first, and it was a woman, young woman, describing her day, the day before, her attempts to find somewhere for herself and her family to live or to stay just that night. And she was really precise. I've no idea who she was. I never looked to see who she was, but she was really precise. She was excellent, you know, and very, very clear. And what really grabbed me was when she said that her partner couldn't help because he was at work. And I thought, well, that's extraordinary, really, you know, because we do have a kind of stereotypical image of what a homeless person looks like and behaves like. And yet this was just a working class family doing what society almost dictates that they do, and they didn't have anywhere to live. I thought, well, there's a story, you know. I thought at first 24 hours in her life as she attempts to find somewhere. And then I thought, no, I'll extend it a bit so that we see her and him successfully find just a room for a night so that we understand then what they're doing the next day. And that's where the idea for the story came from. I started it literally within minutes. I went up to my office and started writing what we call the treatment or the plan for the story.
Of course, Roddy could have written a book about homelessness, but he decided to write a screenplay because he believes film has more emotional impact.
I wrote the treatment, I think, in about 3 days, and I sent it off to a woman called Emma Norton at Element Pictures, and she got back really quickly. So although it took 2 years to make the film, that's actually a very short amount of time.
Right.
And I remember in our innocence, we were wondering when we started whether, you know, the problem would be sorted out by the time the film came out.
And it would be irrelevant.
Yeah. Well, if not irrelevant, less relevant.
Yeah.
But no, it's actually more relevant. It seems that the problem is worse. I suppose as I was writing it, I was thinking a bit of Family, the television series I wrote. And it was broadcast in 1994 about a woman, Paula Spencer, who had been in a bad, bad marriage.
Yeah.
And half the adult population of the country watched that every night for 4 weeks in May of 1994. And the viewing figures got higher with each episode. Now, I don't expect anything like that in this one, but
right.
It did have its impact.
Is that when you were read off the altar?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I got death threats and hate mail, and my mother was pushed by somebody, even, believe it or not, for giving birth to me, whatever. But she was quite proud of that.
And why? Was it because you were...
All sorts of reasons. Undermining Irish marriage was one. Depicting working class life in a way that was ugly in another was another. The suggestion that an Irish man would beat his wife was a... And all sorts of daft and less daft reasons. But I'd lifted a stone that a lot of people didn't want lifted. And bizarrely, it coincided within about 4 days with Riverdance sequence in the Eurovision.
Oh, yeah?
When Ireland suddenly became the sexiest place in the world. And it was brilliant. I mean, like a lot of people, we didn't watch the songs, we watched Riverdance. And it was extraordinary. It was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then 4 days later, episode one of Family was broadcast. And there were people contrasting it and saying, just when Ireland was being depicted at its best, this guy comes along and depicts it at its worst. So, you know, mad.
Roddy Doyle, whose film Rosie opens in cinemas next week. Well, Oliver Callan returned to the airwaves last night and he certainly gave the week a good kicking.
Sup, Murphs? I've got some news for you that's going to make you real happy.
You're moving me to another department. OMG, Leo, thank you so much. You're such a ledge back. Housing is like a total mare.
No,
wow,
dude.
Wow.
I've just figured out the place for our next Twitter selfie.
Oh.
Okay, it's the new Krispy Kreme donut shop.
What?
It's so popular it's bringing Blanchard's down to a grinding halt and making it look like downtown Baghdad,
ugh,
which is totes an improvement. Plus, homeless figures are going down with all the people stuck in traffic overnight.
Excuse me, no, wrong. The homeless figures are incorrect.
What?
Because of the strong dynamic initiatives rolled out by my department.
Murphs.
We're building 20,000 homes a year, including 300 rapid builds a
Murphs.
Month with our policies.
God, I really don't like this new angry, shouty Murph.
So regardless of the actual numbers, I can tell you can't correlate that the snipers and the naysayers and the do-nothings in Sinn Féin, thanks to my department, will soon be enough hovels for all the povs going forward.
Murphs, relax. Calm the jets. Just because pensioner homelessness has gone up 64%.
Which means there's 36% who aren't homeless.
And house prices and rents are at the highest ever level.
27% of 13 people who avail of our schemes were more than 40% satisfied.
Ease down, Murphs. Take a chill pill.
What?
Everyone is so broken from the never-ending crises that they've become preoccupied with non-stories like the meaningless presidential race.
Right.
So don't be a buzzkill, or a Peter Fitzgerald as we call him. Was that his name? He was so forgettable.
But it's unfair that people are focusing on the bad job I'm doing and letting Simon Harris off the hook.
Yeah, but I can't be mad at Harris because he's making everyone forget he's a terrible health minister even better than I did.
Yeah.
One repeal tweet at a time.
I don't know how much more I can take. I mean, the Shinners were really gunning for me with that no confidence vote.
Dude, if the Shinners were really gunning for you, you'd be missing some kneecaps. Burn, Catherine, burn.
Ugh, her, she said a housing development would make Inchicore worse. How could anything make Inchicore worse?
Man, I hate seeing you down like this. How about we just go to the Lemon and Duke for a craft beer to cheer you up?
I can't risk it. What if the opposition call me out for not working hard enough when we are well on the way to discuss approval to zone to plan DeVita to approve the possible building of 3,000...
Okay, stop with the stats. Ugh.
What?
The thing you're forgetting about the opposition is there is no opposition, man.
What?
Fianna Fáil abstained during your no-confidence vote, remember?
That's true.
Sinn Féin are getting quieter and quieter because they totes want to go into coalition so bad.
Okay.
And Labour are like Peter Fitzpatricking themselves out of relevance.
Right.
Look, the opposition is like our Project Ireland 2040.
Yeah.
It doesn't really exist.
Oh my God, you're so right. Thanks, Leo, my man.
Totes.
High five, Tish.
Amazeballs.
Oh, that was my face.
I know.
From Callan's kicks last night. Well, rugby royalty Brian O'Driscoll joined Ryan Tuberty on Monday to chat about a documentary he's made with producer Craig Doyle. Shoulder to Shoulder explores the power of rugby and how the game has transcended religious and political barriers. One of the places Brian visited for the film was the village of Lochgall in County Armagh, where the traditions of the Orange Order have remained strong.
One of the masters of one of the
lodges
came up and said, oh, you know, you'll have a go at the Lambeck. And I was like, sorry, what was that? And he said, you'll have a go. And I kind of had a split second moment of, what am I going to do here? Still, could we just pause time and let me just think about this? But do you know what? I was like, right, I'm going to go with the flow.
And what
here.
Was the pause for?
It's like, I know this is a big deal, you know, to them, but I know it's a big deal from a Republican perspective of what the Lambeg represents. But yet I thought, this guy's asking me, I'm sure they don't flippantly ask anyone to come up and play their drum, particularly, you know, a Catholic from the South or a Republican. So I said, okay, yeah, fine. I went over and
I know
it's on my neck.
I don't know if I'm making this up, but I think your face was a picture. I think every time you hit the skin of the drum, there was a wince, right? And I don't know whether that was going...
I was trying to... Well, it was like a rhythm, actually, I think, more than anything.
Well, that's definitely
thanks be to God. Right. Imagine I was good at it.
But were you feeling,
yeah, and I just saw the cameras come out and phones coming out. I was like, I'm in trouble here. Yeah. I'm in trouble. But, you know,
but like you say,
obviously there was a big fallout from it later on that evening. And then, but I woke up the next day and I thought to myself, if I was put in the same situation, would I do it again? And I absolutely would.
Within an hour or thereabouts, you had BBC Northern Ireland tweeting you playing the Lambeg drum. And then you back to the Roy Best thing, you've got 100 tweets of people saying, fair play, that's a bit of fun, well done. And then you'll get the heads then come at you.
Yeah, they were coming from both sides. I had one from someone in Portadown saying, don't come to Portadown in your Irish jersey or we'll have 8 lads there to give you hiding and your family will be watching. I kind of thought, first of all, an inadvertent compliment that they felt the need for 8 lads to give me a hiding. I thought 4 would have done the job, but that really doesn't bother me.
Was there an element of it when they bring up family or something?
No, because what I looked at was like, there's 13 likes on that and 5 people have retweeted. So I was like, there's a few people think this.
Yeah.
So, and then on the flip side, it's like, how dare you disgrace the Republic that way, and you don't know the symbolism of the Lambeg and so on. Yeah. So 800 years and so on. So, yeah, I got it from both sides.
And then Ryan got on to the anthem question.
Can you ask Brian and Craig why they think Rory Best never sings Ireland's Call as a captain? I think he should.
There is this expectation for those that don't sing Aaron Levine to sing Ireland's Call because, I don't know, maybe some people from the south go, well, we've got this anthem for you guys, so why won't you sing it? But not everyone is into singing anthems. You know, I remember Paul Scholes never sang God Save the Queen before a game. He was like, I'm not singing a song before I go out and play a game
really?
Of football.
It's a singing thing.
So what happened was, I think Ireland Schools, they played, when Rory was playing, they played Ireland Schools against Scotland and he sang Ireland's Call and got super pumped. And he said his first line out went about 25 feet over his jumper. And he didn't know whether it was just a terrible throw or whether it was because it was quite a lot of emotion, having just really been pumped from the anthem. So he said, maybe that's not for me. So he's never sang it.
Yeah.
And that's his prerogative. So
precisely. We should mention Croke Park and Ireland, England, that match, which has to go down as one of the most breathtaking, beautiful, joyous expressions of rugby and country and pride and honour and all of the above, Brian.
It was an amazing day, a really amazing day.
Take us back to the national anthem that day.
I suppose there'd been so much written in the press. It was way more than a sporting context that week. And there was so much talk about God Save the Queen, you know, with the history in Croke Park of being played and how are the public going to react to it? And would there be boos? You know, would it be respected? And we as players were as intrigued as everyone else.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, yeah.
You were kind of wondering. We were
really hoping that it would be respected because that's what rugby is. Yeah. And then the manner in which you could hear a pin drop that day, you know, God Save the Queen played. And I think they all, you know, as players, you could see their reaction afterwards. They really appreciated it. And then we belted out one of the best versions of Aaron Levine ever. I was standing beside John Hayes, you know, in tears. I thought, it's on here. If Hayes is crying, you know, we've got some emotion going. And then we went and literally tore into them. It was one of those weeks that we'd lost to France in the last second of the first game played in Croke Park. Mm. The thought of losing 2 on the bounce when they'd allowed us in the hallow turf of Croke Park while Lansdowne Road was being regenerated was unthinkable. So it was an amazing, amazing day and one that I look back on as a one-off occasion. It's right up there.
It must be.
Rugby legend Brian O'Driscoll heard on The Tuberty Show on Monday. While the presidential candidates deployed themselves around the country this week, over on the other side of the pond in Birmingham, the B words, Brexit and backstop, were never far from the news as the British Tory party faithful gathered for their annual conference amid a level of infighting that only the Tories could muster coming up to crucial negotiations. DUP leader Arlene Foster cut up rough, raising questions about the Good Friday Agreement, and Boris Johnson lobbed his Chuck Checkers custard pie. But for Theresa May, the pressure was on to delete all memories of her disastrous keynote speech last year. So what better way than to sashay on stage to the music of a noted European supergroup?
We could just keep playing that, but let's not. I suppose we better discuss why we're playing it. The reason why we're playing it is right here in front of me, I have to say, because I have the front pages of tomorrow morning's newspapers here in front of me. The Guardian, the Daily Telegraph, the Times London edition and the Financial Times all lead with photographs of the British Prime Minister Theresa May shimmying her way onto the stage at the Tory party conference to the sound of Dancing Queen. John Downing, what was she thinking?
Well, she's had a horrific week, and this is a check your prejudices and see moment, you know, so either she was extremely brave or she's a very silly woman indeed, and I don't think she's a silly woman. Perhaps she was trying to out Boris or give it a bit of Boris. He's been at that kind of carry on, that kind of buffoonery for most of his political life, actually, you know. So, I mean, why not?
Why not? There's so many reasons why not, Shane.
I'm only thinking God only knows what Leo is thinking. Maybe he'll do something similar now. The next Fine Gael or Desha or something, you know.
Who's going to be his Boris?
What track he'll come out to.
Because I do wonder, I mean, her spin people are obviously involved, Marie Sherlock.
You know, it's about the likability of Theresa May, I think, is the key issue here. And she often comes across as, you know, somewhat austere, somewhat reserved or whatever. And if she's to try and bring the British people with her, then they have to kind of like her. So in some ways, I think her back is to the wall at the moment with all the mess that is going on, the internal divisions within the Tory party. So why not?
Ruth Coppinger.
Yeah, no, if we had time to discuss this, it would actually be quite interesting because it's so funny what's happening in society. Like, people are becoming quite politicised, as we saw today, as we see in America, you know, women walking out over the horrific Kavanaugh hearings, etc. But yet at the top of society, you have establishment politicians who made such a fool of themselves as she did at her last conference, and also such a cringeworthy the appearance when she danced with African children in an act of cultural appropriation or whatever. They now have to satire themselves at their own party conference. You know, it used to be you came forward with a slogan, with ideas at a party conference.
She did that too, though, didn't she? She gave a speech that was very well received after the dance.
Really? I just saw the video and I couldn't watch or hear anything more.
It was a pretty hefty speech.
All right, so the likability factor did not work for Ruth Coppinger tonight, but the rest of the panel seemed to like Theresa May a little bit better after her shimmying.
Sarah McInerney and her backing singers, John Downing, Shane Castles, Marie Sherlock, Fergus O'Dowd and Ruth Coppinger, who were in glorious harmony, at least on that topic, on Wednesday's late debate. Well, miles away from that particular dance floor, the Brexit boulder continues to roll. Paddy O'Gorman visited an open-air market in Clocker in County Fermanagh, close to the border, where many traders fear for their livelihoods.
Up here, like, there is no border. Yes. You can just get it. Drive your car, you're not stopped.
Do you remember the days when there was a hard border?
Oh, I do, of course. Yeah. Like, I went to work and every time you went to work, you were getting your boot emptied, like, stuff threw out on the side of the road and everything, like, and your neighbours were stopping you, asking your name. These are people living up the street from you.
UDR soldiers?
Yes, yes, UDR people, like, my next door neighbours. To go back to anybody in uniform, like, stops you. And coming from the generation that I come from, I would take a front to anybody stopping me and asking things that I say, what business is it of theirs? Nobody wants to go back to that.
If there was a hard border, I don't know. I can't even contemplate it because we would do the hedging for the farmers, north and south.
And you don't want to see that coming back?
Absolutely not.
For me to get here, I have to pass the border 5 times to get here. I'm coming from Jonesborough, Armagh. I have to go into the Louth Armagh border and then I'm passing back into Armagh again and I'm back into the Monaghan side. And then I'm coming back, and we're actually in Fermanagh here at the minute. People say soft border, hard border. A border is a border. There's times we don't want to go back to, so.
I'm selling here, and even for the Daily Mail, it's not going to be good going across these borders now, you know. They're going to be checking cars, they're going to be checking vans, they're going to be checking lorries and everything, you know. We'll have to go back to border and white diesel. This is a shame, going through the borders.
Paddy O'Gorman reporting for the Today Show with Sean O'Rourke. John Kelly's Mystery Train, weekdays on Lyric FM, is always a great listen. But on Sunday evenings, John is joined by a special guest who chooses the music for the Sunday service. Last week, Shannon's singer Irla Linard was in studio and they talked about the Coolé Gaeltacht, where Irla grew up, about his work with the Afro-Celt sound system and, of course, the gloaming. And we also heard songs from some of Irla's favourite artists, including the sublime Joni Mitchell.
You mentioned Joni Mitchell there. Mm. And she's, to my mind, in that kind of top tier of the songwriters. But I get the sense that a lot of blokes in particular don't pay as much attention to Joni Mitchell for the usual reason, because she's a girl. I think that's affected her, how she's perceived.
No doubt. I would be compelled to agree with you. I mean, as a composer, a writer of words and music, I don't think she can be matched.
And there's a genius about her, which is astonishing, really, when you realise how young she was when she wrote some of the songs. And I cannot imagine. I mean, when I was 20, I couldn't tie my shoelaces, you know?
I mean, she's a philosopher. She's a stupendously brilliant love poet.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's wise and it's mature and it's grown up, and you think, well, maybe she'd been through all sorts of experiences, you know, relationships and but the understanding of relationships and so on is kind of astonishing for someone so young.
There's an honesty to her, which is, I really think, well, I don't know how to say this, but I don't know if men can be that honest. She is so honest about the kind of train wreck of a lot of the relationships, you know. Whereas she doesn't want what she has.
I think Dylan, Springsteen, all the rest of them, much as I love them, and Leonard Cohen, all the rest of them, there's an element of posture about this sort of male sort of figure. Whereas Joni doesn't seem to care what you think of her so much, you know.
I think we know by now that she really doesn't give a hoot about that. She is, to me, in that sense, if there is such a thing, the pure artist, the untrammeled, unconfined artist, very sure voice, and just so profound in her observations of herself, her own failings, and you know, the depth of her philosophical scrutiny is very touching, I find.
It's life's illusions that I recall. I really don't know life. I really don't know life at all.
She's magical, all right, Joni Mitchell, and you can catch John Kelly's Mystery Train Sunday to Thursday, 7 to 9 on RT Lyric FM. For many of us, Doreena Allen's Simply Delicious cookbook is a mainstay in the kitchen, 150,000 copies sold in the first year, and great care was taken to make sure each recipe actually worked. 30 years on, the book has been updated, and Doreena joined Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday to talk about Simply Delicious, the classic collection.
You finessed it a little bit. I see you've gone metric this time.
Yes, we have, because all the young ones are in metric and I'm still in pounds and ounces in my head.
Patrice. Am I right in thinking, Doreena, there might be just a little less butter and cream in some of the recipes?
Oh, certainly not.
No?
No, no. As you know, I've always used butter and cream and lots of extra virgin olive oil and all of that as well, and felt so strongly about that butter is really good for us and healthy for us, and it's a shortcut to flavour as well as being the most nutritious thing. And I remember when I was filming those series, I wish I'd kept some of these letters, but there was one particularly vitriolic letter from somebody saying, you know, you should be ashamed of yourself. Don't you realise you should be recommending a low fat instead of butter, and have you no sense of responsibility? And I said, well, I don't think so. You know, thousands of generations of Irish people have lived on butter. And at least 4 decades later, when Asim Malhotra and his team looked at the research and found not a jot of research to actually link butter and fat to any kind of cardiovascular disease, that's really important for people to know.
Right, but on the ingredients, I mean, I've spotted parsley oil and oros and Pedro Jimenez jelly with your chicken liver patty.
Yes.
Are they all new additions?
Yes, so we've done little tweaks on some of the recipes, just made them a tiny bit more contemporary, but the essence of them is exactly the same.
Is your 3-minute fish the fastest recipe in this book?
The 3-minute fish is fantastic. And, you know, when people say to me they can't cook, I just say to them, no, of course you can flip and cook. Just like, here's a couple of recipes that I can give you that you, even if you've never held a knife in your hand before, you can make. And that's just slicing little pieces of lovely fresh fish on a plate, sprinkle a little olive oil and a bit of sea salt and a few fresh herbs over the top, put it into the hot oven, and in 3 minutes you have
a delicious. The texts and the tweets are flooding in. Colm says, I was making brown bread once without much success. I was using a Ballymaloe recipe and rang for advice. The woman on the phone asked if I would like to speak with Doreena. It was like ringing heaven and getting God. She solved the problem.
Oh, that's so sweet. I hope your bread's going well.
Doreena Allen heard on The Today Show on Tuesday. Earlier on the Tubridy show, we heard a really honest account of one man's struggle to overcome compulsive eating. John suffered from this addiction for many years. He weighed in at 20 stone, and he told Ryan how it affected his everyday life.
I was born with an inclination towards compulsivity, addiction, whatever you want to call it. And I just picked food, or food picked me at some point. And as the years went by, I just kept leaning and leaning and leaning onto it. And by the time I realised there was a problem, it had gone too far, you know, and I couldn't kind of remedy it.
And on a good night of major eating for you, when you were right in the thick of it, tell us what you'd be ordering.
Oh, Jesus. I could have gone, let's say I went home and had my normal dinner. And
give us an idea of what that might
be. That'd just be like meat, potatoes, vegetables, whatever that may be. And then I'd jump into the car and I'd head into town, and I could go to a chipper and have a meal there. And then I could drive to a shop and get like two or three bars of chocolate, a couple of bags of crisps, a couple of drinks, sweets, a tub of ice cream, lots of special offers, you know, multi-packs, things like that, and bring that home and eat that, you know. And that could all be in the space of 2 hours, like, you know, eating tens of thousands of calories, you know.
And for you to eat, say, an ice cream.
Yeah.
Is that like a nicotine addict having a cigarette? I mean, was it the same hit?
Yeah, it was just like, you know, when you get some food that when you're craving it, like, you just get this, you know, this release, this relief that you've had it, you know. And yeah, but you only get that like really from the first kind of bite, you know, and then you have this compulsion just to keep eating and eating and eating, you know, and you're not getting anything from it, but you can't stop at the same time.
You held down a few jobs.
Yeah.
You travelled well. So it wasn't completely debilitating in some ways.
No.
So, and yet you felt at one point, need to confront this.
Yeah. So like I spent like from the age of about 10 or 11, I started dieting, and all through like my teens, I was dieting and going to like trying all these fad diets, all these books that came out, going to weight loss clubs and all this. And as a teenager, I had a little bit of success, like I'd lose a little bit of weight here and there, but like the diets always had a time frame, and as soon as the time frame would expire, I'd just start eating again.
It took John a long time to build up the mental stamina to go to a group meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. He's now got the coping mechanisms in place and has never felt better.
You know, I've been going now for probably 2.5 years. I've had a full physical recovery. For anybody that looks at me, they wouldn't believe that I was probably 20 stone before, you know.
Yeah, and you know, because it's anonymous, we won't be taking pictures of you for our Facebook page, but I will say this much.
Yeah.
You know, when you walked into the room, I thought you were the guy with the guest.
Yeah.
And I'm not lying, like you just don't look like a man who was near 20 stone at all. But you look, you know, so fit and well that clearly you're like a textbook result for them.
I don't know about that, you know, but for me, yeah, physical recovery was quite good. But the recovery I've had in other areas of my life is not as visible, I suppose, to others, but it is to me.
I can imagine.
Like the way I deal with life is just totally different. My relationships with my family and friends have changed beyond I ever thought they would.
In what sense?
Well, like I spent 15 or 20 years avoiding everything, you know, avoiding anything and everything just so I could get away. Whereas now I can go and spend time with my family and friends and be present and just enjoy their company without, you know, wanting just to run out and get in the car and go and eat, because that was the only way I could cope. Now I can just sit there and just enjoy it.
And you can listen back to the full interview on the RT player. GAA guru Micheál Omorohertig officially retired 8 years ago at the age of 80. But there's no fear of him, and he's now the face of Positive Ageing Week, which runs until tomorrow.
Page 4 of the Examiner today, where Micheál is pictured. Are you abseiling down the side of a cliff there in Dingle, or outside Dingle, Micheál?
Well, it's not a cliff, it's a dune.
It's a dune?
a fortress.
Right, okay.
And I grew up pretty near that, and we were used to going up and down into little Cushin Gall and Cushin the Goppel and Cushin the Torn and Cushin the Caroig and so on. So it's home territory to me around there.
Yeah.
Positive ageing, there's a lot of talk about it recently, and it's a long day from the time that Mauricio Sullivan wrote long ago, Fehebli an Afas, Fehebli an Fuive Law, Fehebli an Igma. And then he added, that would bring you to 60. And then he said, Fehebli an Gurkuma Unuas, 20 years when nobody gives a hoot whether you're there or not. And they're talking now about 50% of those born after 2000 will reach 100 years of age. So things are changing in the right direction, I must say.
You're 88, I suppose.
Yeah, well, age, birthdays were never a big thing in Kerry. And lots of people now, maybe of previous generation, never knew what age they were or not.
They didn't. Are you serious? They did,
I'm serious. Right. I'm always serious.
No, you're not.
Quite a few now would have gone to America. And when I was growing up now, you'd often hear, such a person has written home for his age. They would write to the church. They needed some evidence of age, and then they were all baptised.
That's right.
And the inquiry would come to church, but you'd hear then, people then would come to the conclusion he must be close to whatever age they get social security.
All right. Yeah, yeah.
It's in recent times that birthdays have become big things.
From the Ray Darcy Show on Wednesday. At the recent ploughing championships, Mona O'Donoghue-Concannon, who runs a beef, dairy and suckler farm, took the title of Woman Farmer of the Year. For Countrywide, Brenda Donoghue took a trip to Clare Galway to meet Mona, a woman who effortlessly wears several hats as a farmer, a mother, a carer and a rural activist.
Well, in 2008, my mum passed away suddenly. She had been ill and unfortunately she passed away, so I care for my brother who has special needs, who had a brain injury when he was 11. So
what happened to him?
He had a car accident. So he came to live with me. So I had to find something that was going to work. So I spoke to my husband and we decided that I loved the animals so much that I just come working on the farm full time.
I think a lot of people will identify with that when they're in a situation that they have to care for somebody and they need to earn money as well. And you found that farming was that bridge for you?
It was. Well, it was more for Mark, my brother, than anything else, because he could be with me on a daily basis and he was out and about, and we kind of looked at social farming as a model for him. We had done a bit of research, it was done in England, so we decided that we'd look into it, and it has worked really well, because before he started farming full time, he used to have a lot of seizures and get very sick, but thanks be to God, in the last 4 years he hasn't had a seizure since he was out full time farming.
That's amazing.
Mm. When Mark got his accident in 97, his prognosis was not very good. He was in a coma for a long time. We thought he would never talk or walk, and now he's milking cows, so never give up. It's always about determination, and he's just so much happier out in the farm, and he can enjoy his time with the animals, and like, you'll see him talking to them. And he has his own animals as well. We can't forget that. He has loads of his own cows himself, so they're the special ones in the parlour.
Is your brother Mark?
That's right, yep, that's Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Brenda.
Do you love the farm?
I love it.
And are you very proud of your sister?
I am.
Why?
Because she's my world, and she does everything for me. Before, I was always inside, and in the night time I couldn't sleep, because I had no fresh air.
That's quite emotional with him saying you're his world.
I didn't pay him to say it, I promise.
Brenda Donoghue reporting for Countrywide. Last Saturday's documentary on One was entitled Finding Private Branch, produced by Mary Elaine Tynan and Donal O'Herlihy. It told the story of Dubliner Dick Tynan, who joined the American Army in the 1950s. He bonded, through their love of jazz, with another American private called Howard Branch. Tragically, both men were involved in a military truck accident which killed Howard. And here's the moment in a military hospital when Dick's sergeant breaks the news about Howard.
I have a visit from Sergeant Kelkin, my squad leader. I asked him, I quizzed him about the other casualties. And I said, what about Howard Branch, my buddy? And he looked at me for a while and he said, no, he didn't make it. Oh, okay. And he says about charity, so my God, I feel kind of guilty. And it resonated with myself, because even no sooner gone, I said, yeah, you're not the only guy that feels guilty.
In fact, as a result of the crash, Dick developed post-traumatic stress disorder, which went undiagnosed for almost 60 years. He asked for help from the US military to pay for the treatment, and they fought him all the way. He was challenged to prove what had happened the day of the crash, and this led him to track down Howard's younger brother, London, and leads him to this cathartic moment in a Skype call after nearly six decades.
Mm-hmm. I know people say, oh, don't be ridiculous, but true. It's true. Had I not made room for Howard,
Would he be alive? Would we be talking right now?
Well, we could speculate on that from now on. You were carrying out an order.
Yes.
From a superior officer.
Yes.
So I think you were simply doing what you were supposed to do.
Oh, I don't know what I can say here. I'm so relieved to talk to somebody
yes.
connected to him biologically. Mm-hmm. And to say that, you know, well, he's here with me.
Yes.
So does Dick Tynan beat the US military and get his PTSD treatment? All will be revealed in Finding Private Branch, which is available from the Doc on One website as a podcast. Drama on One last Sunday night was Shouting Out Silence, written and performed by Louise Lewis and devised in collaboration with Goretti Slaven. The play traces the last hours of Lizzie's life, a woman who's never spoken about her past until this moment.
I remember it. I do. Standing on Bray Head. Prayers all the way up. The promise of an ice cream on the way down that was never got. Our one day out, the sand in our toes, paddling for hours. None of us could swim, of course. Never taught. Sure, who'd teach you? Herself in the habit? I don't think so.
From Shouting Out Silence, last week's Drama on One. Well, next Tuesday, Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue will present Budget 2019. And ministers have been in and out of his office to plead their case.
Oh. Ah, Minister Wango.
Fiscal, I decided to bait the rest of them and have my budget fit over nice and early.
A very good idea.
You've left the people of rural Ireland behind. Oh. All I have for the Department of Rural Affairs is the boot of an obelisk going in a ditch and a budget that wouldn't buy a packet of Lincoln biscuits.
Listen to my lovely voice. I'm presenting a children's TV programme? Oh,
I came in here raging now. I can't remember why.
That's right. Rainbows and lemony clouds.
I'm feeling slightly sleepy and then...
Yes.
And cheerful and warm inside.
I'm just a malevolent, uncaring neocon smarting under a cheerful, cuddly countenance.
Sorry, what was that?
Oh, nothing. Just let my happy voice wash over you.
Okay, bye.
Next.
On behalf of the Independent Alliance, I'm here to demand granny flats, granny caps, granny vans and granny lamps.
You sound like General Hux from The Last Jedi.
I'm not going to fall for your shtick like half the media.
Would a man that sounds like this do nothing for the old, the poor, the tired?
Wow, I never noticed you twinkle. Smile before Pascal. It reminds me of Roro, cuddly toy I had as a boy.
That's right. Just look at my dimples.
What did I come in here for again?
You came in for a hug. This is what I do anytime someone says vultures are tracker mortgages. Make it melt away with my dimples.
Right.
Oh, I'm cute, all right. Like a bunny with razors for teeth.
From Callan's Kicks last night, but I leave you now with music from Wednesday night's arena. Mezzo-soprano Paula Murray with an aria from the Bizet opera, Carmen. Gurumaga Vosfragoluther, Gideon Chachtan Shahuggin, Gideshav Slán.
J'irai chez mon ami.